Very nice to be here at this exciting conference, learning about so many different things, and I really appreciate going after Herb, so there's already a great introduction to what I'm going to talk about today. And I'll emphasize in the time that I have really a bunch of new results, data taken by my two outstanding graduate students, Pankaj Khandelwal and Nick Kuzma, in the basement of the Sloan Physics Lab at Yale University, where we've looked at samples provided by our collaborators Lauren Pfeiffer and Ken West. And we couldn't have done these experiments without the support of this NSF career grant and the assistance of our experimental colleagues at Yale and Bob Willett at Bell Labs. Furthermore, in making measurements in an area as complicated as this, it's important to have patient theoretical colleagues that respond to the same question again and again and again. And I'd like to particularly acknowledge the patients of Sugir Sachdev and Nick Reed at Yale, Alan McDonald and Steve Gerber in Indiana, and Shivaji Sandi at Princeton. So here's a pictorial outline of what I'm going to talk about. This is a simple schematic, two-parameter phase space with filling factors starting from zero and going up on this axis, temperature starting from zero and going up on this axis, 1.5 Kelvin is around here. What Herb was just talking about was the interesting spin physics around a filling factor nu equals 1, which is expected theoretically to be a ferromagnetic ground state, and experimentally it seems to be the case. If you sit right at nu equals 1 and go up in temperature, you see the neutral spin flip excitations, which experiments seem to support as being spin waves. And if you vary the filling factor on either side of nu equals 1, you see either the positively charged spin flip excitations, which are anti-skirmions, or the negatively charged spin textures, which are skirmions. And these are all very interesting objects because they only exist due to the presence of strong electron-electron interactions in the system. And we know there's another interesting filling factor here, filling factor 1/3, which is a special filling factor. It's the fractional quantum Hall ground state that we've studied the most. It's a special filling factor because of the existence of the electron-electron interaction. So it's an important experimental question to investigate this same neighborhood and see whether we see anything remotely like what we have already observed near nu equals 1. In order to do that, there are a couple things that you need to do. In our earlier measurements, which were carried out in Rob Tico's lab at Bell, we were working with roughly an 8 Tesla field and samples with densities of 15 times 10 to the 10. So in order to get down to this filling factor range, we had to increase the field and have the density, which got us down to nu equals 1/3. And another important thing, as everyone knows, is you have to go to lower temperatures. We can't stay up around 1.5 degrees anymore. We have to lower the temperature. And it took quite a bit of work, but eventually we got it to go. So a quick reminder of what NMR experiments can tell you about the quantum Hall effect. We're really doing the simplest type of nuclear magnetic resonance experiment. It basically rests upon the Zeeman interaction of a nuclear magnetic moment with an externally applied magnetic field. If you had a spin and a half nucleus, you'd have a two-level system with more nuclear spins in the lower energy state than the upper energy state. You could apply an alternating magnetic field, and if the frequency of the field exactly matches the energy difference between these two levels, you absorb photons while making a nuclear spin flip transition. And we can measure this frequency very accurately. The frequency, because it's given by this interaction, tells you directly what was the local magnetic field at the nuclear position when you made the measurement. And that magnetic field is almost entirely the laboratory magnetic field, again, something in the order of 10 Tesla or so, with a very tiny contribution that is due to the spin magnetization of the electrons at the site of the nucleus that you get your signal from. Okay? So it's a local probe. And since the nuclei are spaced every 2.5 angstroms or so in all dimensions in the quantum well, we're probing length scales that are much smaller than most other experiments can tell you about. Again, as Herb pointed out, the spin magnetization is interesting because the electron-electron Coulomb interaction makes it do things that the field shouldn't, and these papers predicted that we would find interesting things long before we knew we should. So the only problem with doing NMR experiments in the quantum Hall effect is, unfortunately, two-dimensional electron gases live in very tiny quantum well structures. It takes a very long time to grow big quantum well structures. And that means that basically you're only interested in a tiny fraction of the entire sample. That's the only part of the sample that electrons live in. So we need some kind of trick to boost the quantum well signal such that it's much higher relative to the part of the sample you don't care anything about. And what we do is something called optically pumped NMR, which has four steps that I'll show pictorially on two view graphs ahead. And it really is based on something discovered experimentally by Georges Lampel in bulk silicon back in 1968, and it's been studied by many people in between. Okay, so the types of samples that we're looking at are multiple quantum well samples that have quantum wells of order, gallium arsenide quantum wells around 300 angstroms thick, that are well separated from one another by barriers which are on the order of 3,600 angstroms thick. So these multiple quantum wells are isolated from one another in contrast to other multiple quantum well samples we saw earlier this week. We have many quantum wells just to get more signal from the region we're interested in, and we're hoping, and it seems to be the case, that these quantum wells are really identical. The electrons in the quantum wells come from silicon delta dopant spikes, which are in the middle of each of these barriers, and we get electron densities for this particular sample size around 7 times 10 to the 10 per square centimeter. Here's what actually happens pictorially in the optically pumped NMR experiment again. We're really only interested in getting an NMR signal from these tiny gallium arsenide regions, and we don't want a signal from any other part of the sample. However, if we were going to do a normal NMR experiment, we put the sample in the magnets, and some equilibrium nuclear magnetization would develop in the sample. Let's say I'm looking at gallium 71 nuclei. And that magnetization would basically be uniform in space along the length of the sample. So the first thing I do is I want to kill that magnetization everywhere, because I want to use some trick to see just the gallium arsenide. So I apply a series of RF pulses which saturates the magnetization, and if I did an NMR measurement at that point, I would see nothing. Okay. Now the trick is, since I've got nothing, I want to build up the signal in the part I'm trying to study before it grows into the part I'm not interested in. So to do that, we shine light, which is circularly polarized, and a wavelength of around 811 nanometers, which is incident on the top surface of the sample. It passes unabsorbed through the Al-gas barriers and is absorbed in the gallium arsenide quantum wells. The power levels we use are typically 1 to 3 milliwatts. This creates extra electron hole pairs in the gallium arsenide quantum wells. The electrons, because the light was circularly polarized, are out of spin equilibrium with the electrons that were there by chemical doping. This is precisely the condition that Oberhauser said many years ago would give rise to non-equilibrium nuclear spin polarizations. In fact, we see that. We get large nuclear polarizations in the gallium arsenide, which actually are not only large compared to equilibrium, but point in the opposite direction compared to the equilibrium magnetization. They point against the magnetic field. As you leave the light on, this is a steady state experiment basically, as you leave the light on for longer periods of time, 100 seconds or so, the nuclear spins in the quantum well, which couple to their neighbors through a nuclear dipole-dipole interaction, actually lead to a one-dimensional spin diffusion of this spike of nuclear magnetization out into the aluminum gallium arsenide barrier, so that gallium nuclei of the same type, gallium 71 nuclei, that live in the Al-gas where there are not two-dimensional electrons also start to get this negative and enhanced magnetization. This is actually convenient because now we have the ability to get a spectrum which contains signal from nuclei where there are electrons plus nuclei where there aren't electrons, and that allows us to make a relative frequency measurement quite conveniently. Now we turn off the laser and allow the electrons to equilibrate to get back into thermal equilibrium with everything. We typically wait between 1 and 40 seconds before trying to make a measurement, allowing plenty of time for the electron system to return to equilibrium. And then we apply a single 90-degree pulse and measure a free induction decay, and we see a signal. Okay, we actually do the experiment in probes, well, in in this probe. The sample here is a 4 by 6 millimeter chunk of gallium arsenide. The substrate is still on. This is around 30 millimeters side to side. There are no leads attached to the sample, so the quantum wells are just floating. You just have, you see the copper wires which actually form the solenoid which wraps the sample. It's tightly fit around the sample, and it sits on a sapphire base, and there are grooves cut in the sapphire allowing the copper to pass underneath it nicely. Last thing to notice is this whole assembly is sitting on a rotator platform. These are the teeth of the rotator, which allows us to tilt the sample relative to the applied magnetic field direction, which is along the axis of the probe. And you see the leads going up to the resonant part of the NMR circuit. This is a narrow band measurement. Okay, an important thing on that brass housing, which is now here, was the hole in the brass housing. The hole is where the light comes in and hits the sample. The light is brought into the probe using an optical fiber. It's launched from the fiber at that point, which is near the 1K pox. It's linearly polarized, circularly polarized, and then collimated and travels in free space 22 centimeters and hits the sample here. And the spot is big. It's 5 millimeters in diameter, and it covers the sample. So we're seeing a signal from the entire sample all at the same time. This is what a spectrum looks like. If I show you spectra, they'll always look like this. There are two peaks, a B peak and a W peak. The B peak is the signal due to the gallium nuclei in the outgas barriers. The W peak is due to the nuclei which are in the gallium arsenide quantum well. These two types of gallium nuclei have essentially the same chemical environment. They should resonate at the same frequency, except for the fact that the gallium arsenide quantum wells have these two-dimensional electrons. The two-dimensional electrons produce an extra magnetic field because of the contact hyperfine coupling with the nuclear spins. So we have a simple model for what this line shape should look like, which just basically assumes that the electrons are in the lowest subband. The probability of finding electrons in the center of the well is higher than finding them at the edge of the well, and that the optical pumping polarizes nuclei in the center of the well more effectively than nuclei at the edge of the well. Those assumptions lead to this simple form for the line shape. So this right edge of this intrinsic form for the line shape is telling you what is the maximum magnetic field for nuclei in the very middle of the gallium arsenide quantum well. Okay? This crosshatch region is the signal that we would measure if we didn't have many nuclear spins next to one another, but the nuclear spins next to one another produce an extra random dipole field. So if we broaden this intrinsic line shape with the Gaussian, we get this dashed line, which does a nice job of fitting the blue curve, which is the actual data. Okay, it's important to note that if we were to measure the frequency difference between the left edge and the right edge of this intrinsic line shape, this Ks int, we would be getting a measure directly of the electron spin magnetization for the nuclei which are at the center of the quantum well. What we actually measure in practice is, of course, the blue spectrum. So we measure more easily a peak-to-peak splitting. And note that there's a slight difference between this peak-to-peak splitting and the intrinsic night shift, and we correct for that when converting peak-to-peak or night shift measurements to spin polarization measurements. This data happens to be at nu equals a third at 1.5 Kelvin, and it's from a sample with 10 gallium arsenide quantum wells, so you're looking at 10 to the 16 nuclei there. Okay, so much for the intro. Now quickly into the data. Since we are interested in looking at nu equals a third, but had to go to very different samples and much higher magnetic fields in order to do that, the first thing to do is to make sure that we understand the samples that we're looking at. So we go back and repeat measurements already carried out before, and we want to go back and explore the region near nu equals 1 with these new samples. Okay, so the procedure is we're going to set the magnetic field such that we start at a filling factor on this side of nu equals 1, and we're going to use the sample rotator to change the tilt angle of the sample with respect to the applied field. The filling factor will change as 1 over magnetic field times the cosine of the tilt angle, and that will allow us to take a cut in filling factor right through this region. And when we do that, we see, as Herb showed before with the older data, that the night shift, this peak-to-peak splitting between the B peak and the W peak, starts off very small at low filling factors, rises up to a maximum at nu equals 1, and drops down again. Okay, so this is reminiscent of the results from the earlier measurements, which were made in higher density samples at higher magnetic fields. Here we have fields of 3.6 and 3.2 Tesla. Again, the temperature is 1.5 degrees. So this shows us that we know what's happening as we make this sample tilt measurement, because we have data plotted on here using squares and circles for tilting the sample to the left and tilting the sample to the right. And the data lie on top of one another, so we know the angle very accurately. We know the field very accurately because we can measure the NMR frequency with extreme precision. And the last thing is we know the electron density from the position of this peak because we have data in this trace here from three different cool downs, and they all lie right on top of one another, assuming the same electron density, and data taken in a different cool down in a different magnetic field. And the peak for this sample, for example, always occurs at the same filling factor, nu equals 1, assuming exactly the same electron density. And the narrowness of this peak allows us to say that this is the electron density associated with the sample to plus or minus a half percent. So it's not only a very robust value of the density, it's a value that's extremely repeatable. This then allows us to say we know the density of the sample, we can increase the magnetic field up to our full 12 Tesla value and tilt the sample such that we are going to sit right at a filling factor of nu equals a third. And now we're going to take a cut where we walk down in temperature and look at how the polarization of the electron spins changes. And here's what we see. Again, this is a 10-well sample and 12 Tesla field. At very low temperatures, again, you see the two peak spectrum, as I showed you before, the barrier nuclei and the well nuclei. As you warm the sample up from 290 millikelvin towards 12 degrees, this W peak systematically shifts towards the position of the barrier peak. And we can adjust the amplitude of the barrier peak by how long we do this optical pumping. So we don't do optical pumping very long at high temperatures in order to suppress the B peak, allowing us to measure this frequency very cleanly. Okay, so the B peak would still be there if we pumped for longer. So you're just seeing the cold, fully polarized ferromagnet warming and going to a reduced total spin polarization. So we can take many, many measurements like that as a function of temperature and plot them versus temperature here. And you can measure in this fashion the neutral spin flip excitations of this nu equals one-third ground state. The blue data points are for the 40-well sample, which has a slightly lower electron density. And the red data points are for the 10-well sample. Again, the measured night shift is different in the two cases because they both have these different electron densities and also slightly different well widths. Note that the data saturates at low temperatures, but at temperatures, luckily, which are higher than the base temperature of our system. So we bought the right one. And it's also interesting to note that the two data sets are obtained in different tilt angles relative to this fixed field because of the fact that they have different electron densities. Okay, so this is the experiment. We measure the night shift. Now we convert the measured night shift to the intrinsic night shift and then divide by the maximum night shift to convert it to the electron spin polarization. When we do that, the data from the two different samples collapse rather nicely on top of one another. To first order, they're the same. Again, the blue points are for the 40-well sample and the red points are for the 10-well sample. Here again in the inset is the very low temperature region. You see the saturation in both cases. And the error bars are shown here. This behavior, while reminiscent of what you see experimentally at nu equals 1, either in the optical absorption measurements by Bennett Goldberg's group, which are done right at nu equals 1, or our NMR measurements, which were done close to nu equals 1. However, this ground state ferromagnetism is very fragile. This drops off at a very low temperature compared to the Zeeman energy. The Zeeman energy in temperature units is around 3.5 degrees. And you see, if you just go up to the Zeeman energy, you've lost basically half of the maximum polarization. Okay, so that's not so unexpected, but it's nice to see how it actually behaves. Note here that you can actually do a simple functional fit to this data set. This is the 40-well data set, just using a simple hyperbolic tangent function. This was impossible to do at nu equals 1. You couldn't use a hyperbolic tangent to fit it. Okay, so now I'd like to, now that we've established that we see saturation of the magnetization at nu equals 1/3, and we know what the maximum polarization is, now we'd like to sit at a temperature which is low enough to just maximally polarize the spins at nu equals 1/3, start at a filling factor below 1/3, and step through 1/3 and see what we see. When we do that in the two samples, we see this. Again, we're varying the filling factor by tilting the sample in a constant field of 12 tesla. The lowest, or zero tilt angle, is always the leftmost point, and we step through in filling factor like this at 460 millikelvin for the 40-well sample and a higher temperature for the 10-well sample. In both cases, you see a local maximum in the night shift that is centered at nu equals 1/3. There is a difference between the size of the effect. This seems to drop off faster than in this case. You might think that's because they're measuring two different temperatures, but if you see, if you go up to a higher temperature, the two samples look different at the same temperature. If you go up to 1.5 degrees, this is already still much steeper than the other 40-well sample. I should point out that because the 40-well sample has a wider well width and lower electron density, we would expect that its spin stiffness is slightly smaller. That could have something to do with it. Okay, so converting that night shift data to the spin polarization versus nu to look for the spin of the charge excitations at nu equals 1/3. Here's what we see. Again, the local maximum at nu equals 1/3. And we can compare this to what we would expect in various scenarios. If you go back to the earliest model for the fractional quantum Hall effect, Laughlin's theory, you would say that you would have, well, spin was irrelevant, so you would expect no spins to flip as you move away from nu equals 1/3, either on the quasi-particle or quasi-hole side, and we would expect this dashed line behavior, which is clearly not seen in the data. In the mid-80s, Tapas Chakrabarty and co-workers considered the next most likely scenario, which was that you would have one complete spin flip for every quasi-hole or quasi-particle added to the system, and that's clearly also not seen in the data. That drops off much faster than our results. Instead, we can fit this simple formula to both curves and extract the number of flip spins per quasi-hole or quasi-particle for the 10-well or 40-well sample, and you see these numbers, which are clearly not zero, but clearly not one. They're an order of a tenth. And I should point out that these numbers are definitely average numbers because for the number of electrons we have in the system, the first point on either side of nu equals 1/3, we're introducing 400 million quasi-holes or quasi-particles into the system. It's very far from the exact diagonalization calculations. So lastly, in the short time that I have left, now that we've found something interesting going this direction, let's move to the side of nu equals 1/3 and march down in temperature and see whether anything funny happens where we think from that last measurement where we think that we have reverse spins present in the system. And sure enough, something funny does happen. We have what we think is the end of motional narrowing in the system. If you sit at this filling factor where you're below nu equals 1/3 and there seem to be reverse spins present in the system, at high temperatures, the data, which are the solid curves, are pretty well described by this dashed line fit. The dashed line fit had assumed that there is absolutely no variation of the electron spin magnetization along the plane of the two-dimensional quantum well. Okay, all of the line shape came just because of the variation of the electron density along the growth axis, and we assume that whatever happened at one point in the XY plane happened everywhere. Okay, and that dashed line fit did a great job at all temperatures at nu equals 1/3, but if you go away from nu equals 1/3 and go down in temperature, the actual experiment gets much wider than the simple model would predict, and then actually, interestingly, it narrows again. So you can see how this behavior evolves as a function of filling factor. The upper curves here are the night shift versus temperature. The lower curves here are the line width of the well peak versus temperature. And the uppermost curve here is the night shift versus temperature at 1/3. The lowermost red curve here is the line width versus temperature at 1/3. And as you move systematically away from 1/3, the night shift drops down. That's what our earlier results showed. But interestingly, associated with that drop in night shift, there's a systematic deviation of the line width from our expected model at this low temperature that gets worse and worse as more and more reverse spins are present in the system. Okay, so our simple interpretation for this is that at high temperatures, the measured local spin magnetization is equal to the global or total spin magnetization. At low temperatures, this is no longer true, that that whatever reverse spins we have in the system due to our motion away from nucleus of third, they're becoming localized on a 40 microsecond timescale, which is an MR experimental timescale. We have a simple model for that, but I'll defer in the interest of time. You can ask about it if you want. I can also say that we're continuing to make progress in this area. We're going to hear some very interesting talks after the break about double well measurements, for example. For us to get involved in that, we'd have to give up on using these 10-well and 40-well samples. So just in the last couple of weeks, we have data from a single quantum well. This is a 250 angstrom thick gallium arsenide quantum well at 1.5 degrees. It's much harder than looking at a 40-well sample. But the good news is it is possible. And this was about 8 minutes of data averaging at 1.5 degrees. So I expect we'll continue to make progress in this area. And hopefully you can help us understand what we don't. So to conclude, I'll just throw up this view graph, remind you that we can measure the neutral spin excitations that apparently have a small spin stiffness at 1/3. Our big surprise is the data near nucleus of third showing that we seem to have on the order of a tenth of a spin flip per quasi-particle or quasi-hole, which is quite surprising, and we see the end of motional narrowing. Quickly, I'll say that you can see the actual data. Both my students have papers that have appeared in the last couple of weeks describing these results. Quickly, I'll say that the theory would have predicted, either using conventional spin-reversed particle calculations or more recent calculations invoking skirmions, everyone agreed that by the time you got above a 7 tesla field or so, and again, we're doing these measurements in 12 tesla field, you should see zero spin flips for a quasi-particle or quasi-hole. Experimentally, however, the constraints are kind of loose. There was one measurement that we're aware of in a normal sample without pressure being applied, and the data went the wrong way to extract a spin flip per quasi-particle, quasi-hole. Recently, the Oxford group applied pressure and saw, when they went to what they think is G star equals zero, they saw A plus S was 3. So we're clearly within that bound. Thank you very much. Yes?
I'm followed by the temperature dependence of magnetization around
1/3. OK. The thumbnail, yes.
Away from 1/3.
Yes.
What you need to calculate this 0.1 spin flip per quasi-particle.
Yes.
There still seems to be a substantial upward temperature dependence.
Yes, but here.
Can you summarize that?
Okay, yeah, so it's a very good question. The question has to do with, let me go back to the big picture for a second here. Okay, so it's basically the same question from Kravchenko's talk, which is, how do you know that you've gone close enough to T equals zero? And we don't, in the end. I mean, we never will. All I can say is that the KS versus nu measurement was carried out at this temperature, 0.77 K, in this particular sample. Okay? So, and the reason we did that was because at that temperature, you were closer to the limit that the line shape was such that the total magnetization was the same for all nuclear spins. Okay, and once the line shape starts to change like this, okay, then you have to understand why it's changing in order to associate points on the line shape, whether it's the peak or any other point in the line shape, with any particular physical quantity. All right, our model for why the line shape changes is that these higher temperature measurements tell you that there are some number of reverse spins present in the system, and the only way that number of reverse spins can be present for all nuclei is that they cover all nuclei over our NMR timescale. If they don't cover all nuclei over the NMR timescale, if they, let's say, they freeze entirely, then the line shape will look very different. And in order to extract the global spin polarization, which is what you would calculate theoretically, you would need to do some kind of complicated average over this very broadened line shape. Okay. Well, I would say what we definitely have done is we've measured the polarization of the states near one-third at this temperature. Okay, right? Okay. And then once the line shape starts to change, you have to have some model for why the line shape changes before you can do a good job of arguing what the spin polarization is at low temperatures. All right? So if I have a second, I'll just show a simple model for what is happening here, which is our model, so other models could be better, that if you imagine that at low temperatures you have some number of reverse spins present in the system in a sea of majority up spins, if they didn't move at all, then you would have most of the nuclei would see the resonant frequency associated with just up spins, that is, the resonant frequency that you would get if you're right at nu equals one-third. And this minority part of the plane would see a resonant frequency which was somewhere probably on the other side of the barrier. Okay, that's what we've assumed here. If you allowed fast motion of these spins, something that should happen at high temperatures, then through motional narrowing, an NMR process that's observed in many other systems, you would get a single resonance line that was at a frequency which was the weighted average of those two particular frequencies. Anywhere in between, okay, in this intermediate motion regime, you end up getting a very fat resonance line which has a complicated dependence with either of these two limits, right? And so what we think is happening, but we can't prove, right, is that this blow up in the width of the resonance line is associated with the transition between what we know is there at high temperatures, some number of reverse spins, and what might be there where we haven't done the measurements at still lower temperatures. Okay, but to really tell that beyond a shadow of a doubt, the best thing would be to see to see the line shape evolved to the frozen limit, right, which we haven't. Sorry.
Do you see anything like what you call the end of motional narrowing near equals one?
Not yet, but that's where we're looking now, so we'll see. Yeah, there's an obvious place to look.
Yeah, so I'm confused. Here you're saying the line is narrower, it's cooler, but the data shows the opposite.
Well, so it goes, the width is narrow, then fat, and then narrow again. It's just because the two separated lines are separated by farther than their intrinsic width. It's only in the intermediate motion regime that you would get a line which is fatter than, I'll talk to you later. This is very simple. So you see the width, the blow up, the key thing is here. The data show this increase in the line width followed by a decrease. There are like a million explanations for why resonances would get broader at low temperatures. But it's very hard to come up with a scenario which they would get broader and then narrow again. One way for that to happen is if what you're seeing is a transition between a emotionally narrowed line and a frozen line shape, and in between the data is this fat resonance which is as wide as the separation between the two narrow lines. The key thing is in the frozen limit, they have to be farther apart than their intrinsic width, and that's what we think we would have if we had reverse spins present at low temperatures where we haven't made the measurement. In the end, we have to make the measurements at lower temperatures to prove Gamma Shadow Dell, right?
Thank you.
Thank you.